But I think it's come a long way in a couple years.
Yeah. 700 days, sweet spot.
There it is. Are we ready to do this thing? I'm Matt Robinson.
I'm Noah Bissell.
And this is Graining In.
Jake Hill.
A very excited Jake Hill these days.
Yeah. Yep.
Play the music. I'm in the mood to be slow and careful. My body's ready for a mountain climb. All of a sudden it will all become lovely. The flower that opens in the morning light. This, as it always is, a special one. But this one really is a special one because July 11th, 2019, we put out our first guest episode of Graining In. We dropped them in a slew, dropped like four at once, first podcast we were putting out, and we had in that slew, Zach Page as a guest. And we've been calling the reruns when we bring people back onto the pod that have been on once, we've been calling it the apology tour. And there is no apology that needs to be bigger, bolder, and more sincere than the one we are going to issue to us. But that's not the only reason it's special and exciting, because for the second time ever, we are going to try a four-person podcast. The first time we tried, it didn't come out because we didn't know what we were doing with
because
the audio.
Of me. Let's be honest.
But yeah, no. This is a team effort. But we owe Orno Brewing Co. an apology for that one. So look out for them. They will be back. But for the first time, four people, one of them Zach Page and one of them Nick Bonadies.
Bonadies. Good job.
I got it.
How's it going, guys?
Yeah.
What's up?
Yeah. How are you doing, Noah?
I can't quite get my vibe in this double seat here, but I'm great. So a lot's changed since we last talked, I guess, is the quickest way to say this. We are in East Bayside of Portland. Last we talked was in Gorham at Lone Pine. You and Nick are just about to open Bellflower Brewery in this space we sit in, which I have a lot to say about because it's just such a, there's no time like it opening, you know, there's just so many emotions. So I really, if for nothing else, for nostalgia and, you know, reminiscing, but certainly want to get into that and just how it's been for you guys. But I feel like it's hard to do. We kind of have to lay the context for your opening in a pandemic.
Yeah.
Opening on the tail end of a pandemic for sure. But to just maybe start however you guys would like to with kind of laying out how this came to be for starters. And we like to try to lean on the positive side of everything just because it's overtly negative.
Otherwise.
A global pandemic. But I do think there are some, if you look just a little harder, I think there's a lot of silver linings to this. And from the sounds of it, you guys are a great example of that. So yeah, how did we get here?
Want me to go?
Go for it.
All right.
Testing your chemistry is cool.
You know, Zach and I had talked about opening a brewery a long time ago in like 2013 and like had put serious work in, like maybe not serious work, but had put some work into, you know, figuring out if it was possible even. And
went as far as like visiting sites.
Yeah, exactly.
And, really?
Specing equipment. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we even looked at like the night shift spot at some point, like where they were in Everett.
And now to paint that context, when you talk about night shift, and obviously we've done some of it with Zach, but you guys were both at Trillium in the early days inception. And was that how you guys knew each other through that? Or did you know each other even before that?
Nope. That's how we met.
Yeah. Awesome. Through that.
Yeah. Zach had a ponytail and I remember seeing this guy. I was like, oh man, got a ponytail. He's going to be a nice dude to hang out with. That was like funny though. Cause there were like 30 dudes at those like early Trillium days that would just like show up to like help out. And then like slowly everybody just sort of disappeared and we're left with like four of us, I think three or four of us at the time. But yeah, I mean,
not to completely throw it there, but that was the thing me and Matt still talk about. Like that was, I think, very eye-opening to this volunteer culture, I guess, that exists, that I don't know if it was just in my kind of circle or if it was Maine or what, but it was kind of shocking for me to like wrap my head. So there's 30 people that just would work at this brewery for nothing, basically.
I mean, it wasn't a brewery at that point.
So even crazier.
Yeah.
So it's talk about kind of like, why do you think, I guess the question would be like, why do you think, beyond dedication, you guys were some of the last people standing in that slew of volunteers?
Yeah, I mean, I think we both wanted to get in the industry that badly, you know?
Yeah.
And it was like unsolicited help too. I mean, people just heard about this project going on and were, you know, either interested in beer or homebrewers or whatever.
Yeah.
And just showed up. Yeah. You know, hey, JC, what are you doing? Like, want to, you know, get my foot in the door. And, you know, the process of getting Trillium open took so long. I mean, it was what, like,
it was a year and a half.
Year and a half at least. Yeah. But I think we, you know, we just wanted to learn as much as we possibly could.
Yeah.
You were already set at that point on opening up a brewery.
Yeah.
So you just wanted to, you know, get as much information as you could. I wanted to be a professional brewer, you know, coming from the homebrew realm.
Yeah. And is that who a lot of the faces and the characters were that are helping out with primarily homebrewers trying to get some sort of exposure or experience, or is it a friends and family thing?
It was definitely the homebrewers that stuck around the longest, I think. I mean, I can't even remember like a lot of the people that were there, but yeah, it was the homebrewers that, you know, were the ones that hung around the longest, I guess. But yeah, I mean, that's where we met. That was the foundation of the idea.
So we're talking 8-9 years ago, you were like, I'm going to open a brewery.
Yep.
Wow. And that was not even on your radar at all at the time. You just wanted to be in the industry.
I wasn't thinking that far ahead, and I didn't think I could do it at that point. I mean, like every, you know,
PhD,
it's like the trope, like every, you know, every homebrewer says that, like, oh, one day, you know, I'm going to start my own brewery. But that was not my concern. I was just looking for a change, you know, in my career path and wanted to follow my passion. That was my only, I didn't know where it was going to take me or what my role was going to be eventually. I just knew I liked it here and I'm going to stick with it and see where it, you know, where it takes me.
Yeah.
So 1.5 years for Trillium. I know this is going to be a lot quicker here. and also like crazy fucking time. Cause you guys, did your first full turn yesterday, right?
Two of them.
Yeah.
That would have been crazy for me. That was one turn took literally all day for me. But, so yeah, what is how did this all unfold again? All within the pandemic, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know why I'm leaning heavy on the pandemic.
Well, it's the thing over us, right?
But all jokes aside, it is, you talked about how exciting this time is. You can resonate with that. You've been through the process of opening a brewery, but you have all those emotions that are already on the table of starting a business. It's just hard not to imagine that gets magnified or just.
Right.
An order of magnitude bigger when you do add the time that we're in now must add a whole different slew of emotions to the table. But in terms of Noah's question, as the talks that you guys have had over the years or the idea to do this, as that becomes concrete reality, how did that part unfold?
I mean, so for me, like I had like a major life change almost a year ago, you know, at this time, lost my job, got laid off because of the pandemic. And, you know, it was that point where I was like, sorry for the crass language, but fuck it. You know, I'm going to do this. Like
it's
I have
draining in baby. You
know. Yeah, exactly. I have the experience, you know, I have a little bit of cash, some money saved up. I know I can do this. So I started looking around really and just like kind of put my ear to the ground. You know, at first before I found a new job, I was going pretty hard and pretty serious about it, but, you know, I couldn't really find anything that I thought would work, especially in the pandemic. You know, and getting money was going to be hard to finance the whole thing. But then I heard about, you know, the opportunity here through actually the Massachusetts Brewers Guild. You know, it was literally like a phone number posted on a message board that was like, hey, there's a brewery for sale. Call this guy. So like instantly called the number and was like, hey, I'm interested. You know, what's the deal? And the guy on the other line was like, how did you hear about this? It's not supposed to be public knowledge right now. And, you know, I said like, well, I just saw it posted on a forum.
It's
and
definitely public knowledge.
Very public forum.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, started in earnest, like talking with them, and then when I realized it was going to be like feasible, you know, running like back of the pad numbers kind of stuff. That's when I reached out to Zach and I said, hey man, like I have this opportunity, like please come with me. I think it would be amazing to have you on board, and I think that like we could crush this.
Yeah.
And that's when we started talking about it.
Where were you at mentally, Zach, when that phone call came in?
Well, definitely wasn't expecting it. Starting my own company was not in my mind at all. I was just in like a comfortable survival mode, maybe in the pandemic is what I would call it. You know, things were coming back up at Lone Pine where I was at the time in terms of like sales and production. Like it was steady. It was steady work. We were in a groove. If, you know, got over that part of the pandemic where you're just like going, you know, stir crazy. Like we just felt, I mean, the family and I felt comfortable.
Yeah.
But I mean, when Nick called me up, knew the space that, was up for sale. Had obviously worked with Nick for a while at Trillium. And I mean, I've said this before, I know you don't like this term, but it was like a no brainer. For me.
It was a brainer. There's a lot of brainers. It was like, there was a lot of like, oh man, is this actually going to work? Like I'm going to run the math again. Like, does this math look right? Yeah. Okay. Like it's going to work. Hopefully.
Well, I'd imagine you're checking everything 5 times more than I don't, it's hard for me to put into words how I would imagine that would feel of all this inherent risk of opening any business, opening a brewery. Yeah. Brewing industry is like, obviously, you know, pretty well received in Maine, of course, but, so that's, it's just enough stress as is, but then to be like, just the slew of uncertainties that get piled on top of that. If nothing else, I would have to think that also speaks to the no-brainerness of it, to be like, not only am I willing to do this with you, but willing to do it now.
I
had confidence, you know, in us and in our ability to make, you know, make good beer and create a great customer experience. And just with the timeline too, you know, just seeing how long it would take for this, you know, dealing
knowing how long it would take too.
What's that?
Having done this a couple times, like knowing how long it would take.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Going through this process before, you know, we had put a lot of bet on us being at a better portion of the pandemic, you know, when we open our doors, you know, shooting for spring of this year, that, you know, the vaccine would be rolled out to some extent. Hopefully, you know, people feel a little more comfortable coming out and, you know, visiting a new brewery. So that brought a little bit of comfort.
And I mean, I think I said that, or I think I told you this, but like, you know, when I was trying to figure out if it was going to be feasible, one of the things I said to my wife was like, you know, the only person I would ever want to open a brewery with is this guy, Zach Page. And like that, I think like Zach saying yes gave me more confidence in, you know, in the idea and like what we were going to do.
And also just for the context, you know, we're in kind of one of those too good to be true setups where kind of, I mean, you call it a turnkey brewery, right? By definition, I would used to read about those on Pro Brewer and be like, what the fuck is a turnkey brewery? But, when we were starting out, but again, it's hard for me to kind of phrase it just from trying to put myself in your shoes, which is probably not a great thing to do when you're both sitting right here. but you know, a huge part of why this brewery didn't make it was COVID.
Right.
I think just the timing of that. So then to be like, well, we will in the same spot. But I, as you're kind of both kind of alluding to, I think that the trying to project the timing out seemed to be the critical thing in that last push.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, that was one of the first things we talked about was like, all right, when do we think we could actually open and then back everything else into that, you know, is the pandemic still going to be, you know, as intense as it is now? Like, is everybody just going to be locked in, you know, their houses for weeks on end? Like, is anyone even going to be able to go outside? And, you know, I mean, I think the other thing that personally I saw that, you know, states were doing was like allowing stuff like home delivery for breweries. Like, I don't want to drive my Jetta, you know, up Munjoy Hill to like drop off a 4-pack, but I will if I have to, you know, like that's how like deep the passion goes. So I just, you know, I had confidence that we were going to be able to do it.
And we ran a lot of, you know, worst case doomsday scenarios and be like, can we weather through this, you know, for X amount of time? Like, you know, if it takes till the middle of the summer to the fall, like how long, you know?
If you don't mind talking about not to dwell too much there, but just, you know, every business plan has its contingency plans kind of section in it, but this would just be like another level. So was that all kind of like, if, the retail space, you know, within tap rooms and how we can sell beer is constricted to the way it is now for X amount more months. Mm-hmm. That was, it was just different scenarios like that.
Yeah. It's like we won't hire people, you know, it'll just be the two of us. Uh-huh. Like we'll just do everything.
Yeah.
Like, and we'll just keep doing that for as long as we have to, you know, hopefully it won't be for too long, but we'll just keep doing it.
Yeah. I mean, it's looking like you guys time that. Again, knock on wood, a lot of wood to knock on. But it really looks like that timing's, as of the moment, working out. I don't know. You can just sense, at least for me, I think, just a very tangible and what seems to be logical sense of optimism. Vaccine driven for sure. But it's like, okay, like I know people that have gotten vaccinated now. I know them. That's so, I mean, it can't be that far away, you know, for someone like me. But that's awesome. I hugely applaud the just courage really to go for it. And, you know, as a, you know, budding stock expert, you know, as they say, buy the dip, right? So,
and it seems
GameStop,
like where
GameStop.
It seems like where some of that courage comes from is innate trust in each other. Obviously, having background working together, and even when you say when you run doomsday scenario, worst case scenario, the two of us can hold this down together.
Yeah.
In terms of the relationship and what you think works so well about it, what do you guys see as specific roles and like core competencies that complement each other well? What do you see that working relationship being like?
I think to your point first, like another reason why like I felt so comfortable going into business with Nick is that like we're in very similar parts of our lives. We both have two kids, both like a 3-year old and the 1-year old. Like they're both the same.
Age. So you're going to be spending time together anyway, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think we were both in the understanding that like we need to do this, you know, for our families.
Right.
And we, you know, won't let this fail for it. Right. You know, like there's too much riding on this for both of us.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's been easy to be courageous because I feel like we've been too busy to get freaked out.
Oh, I've been freaked out. I've been freaked out for the
I've just been
us,
keeping
probably.
My head like on the work and just trying not to think about it.
Well, talk about just being freaked out in general. Like, forget about COVID entirely, because kind of what I was saying at the beginning, like that 6 months between like we brewed our first batch like a little before Thanksgiving. So basically from early summer and especially those last 3 months leading up, like that fall, that time period in my life is like seared, that just viscerally remember it. Like in every just how it's just so much to process. At least it was for me. I shouldn't project that on you guys, especially because at least you kind of had a sense of it with having, you know, help start other places.
Right.
But yeah, what is that sort of, for me, I can't really describe it any other way than a roller coaster. What has that been like, just far beyond entirely devoid of COVID, but just I think a lot of the self doubt that tends to creep in of like, is there a place for us? But then that, it's almost kind of like it's like this fervent excitement of like, we're doing it, which then like goes to this fear of like, but that means like, I really have to deliver on this. So then that leads to, going so hard into doing every possible thing you can to deliver. And then for me, I mean, that honestly led to a lot of my personal life for that period kind of deteriorating. So then rebuilding that kind of after the fact, but with you guys, I was in a very different situation than you guys. I was younger, certainly, wasn't married, didn't have kids, all that. How's that balance been like, especially when it's just the two of you guys? Mm.
It's challenging. I mean, like even today, you know, like, Zach dropped off his son at daycare, called me on the way here and said, "Hey, I got to turn around. You know, I got to pick him up and go home."
Yeah.
And I was like, "All right, I'll do the CIP and I'll get everything milled for tomorrow and make sure the HLT is full and the CLT is full and get everything prepped." And like, that's it, you know, just do what you have to do to like help out. But like, you know, going a little further into that, you know, our wives are also owners in the business and are participating and, you know, helping us like come up with strategy and like, you know, what we want the brand to be, and making, you know, decisions about, you know, the interior and the experience and how we're going to interact with customers. And, you know, we tried to have meetings like with our kids around, thinking like, all right, they'll just all play in a corner. Nope. Doesn't happen.
It's impossible.
Like, yeah, it's impossible. So like, then we decided like, all right, we're just going to meet, you know, really late at night on Google Hangout when the kids go to bed, or like super early in the morning, uh-huh. like right after we drop them off, you know, uh-huh. one of the two. So that's how we've been like kind of working it so far. I don't know.
Yeah. It's been difficult too, because, I mean, like, I don't know how long kind of build out took for you guys, and, you know, from,
yeah, that's the
hard for the push probably, our lease started in June, I believe, of that year, May or June. So we had that amount of time.
But yeah, it just feels so compressed.
Yeah.
Because, you know, typically you would have that entire time from like, you know, planning and procuring mm-hmm. the, you know, equipment and the build out, the whole thing.
Already
this
here.
Was already, it's already here. It's ready to go. Yeah, like there's very little, you know. And, you know, obviously we want to get like, we want to open as soon as we can. So we have to develop, you know, SOPs for, you know, service. We have to develop the beers, we have to develop the brands, we have to get the, you know, labels made, we have to make sure we can source everything now to
licensed.
Start, but yeah, we have to get licensed. Like there's just so much to do. It's like such a short period of time. So yeah. It's been great to have like the four of us to kind of divide and conquer.
Yeah.
For another thing just that I really just means so much to me about just the opening process for us was, and it sounds like you've already kind of talked about it, the bonding, the natural bonding that happens. Like you're doing this wild, crazy thing, but you're also it makes it palatable when you really need it to be palatable, 'cause you're doing it with someone.
Yeah.
It's such a different situation because, you know, I obviously was doing it with my brother than someone, that I knew well, but I'd never worked with. But for you guys, it's funny since how big the gap was between when you were working together, even living in the same place. So I guess going back to just the, it was only going to be one person, you know, and it seemed like in both of your heads independently, because the being willing to do that so quick is just wild. So, I mean, I think that alone just really speaks to what that level of trust was there. What is it, do you think, in each other? Make each other blush a little bit on what why you were so confident
Zach's already starting.
That relationship would work.
Yeah, I mean, mostly because of our work together at Trillium, like in such a short amount of time. Nick, I mean, you had a tie. I mean, I can't even remember a single one of your titles because you had so many throughout a short, like relatively short time. But like every project that you were in charge of, you just attacked it, like met like every goal that was set before you. I know how stressful those things were, and just saw you like collect yourself. Yes, you're freaking out, but obviously, but we're able to put it together and make like the impossible possible for some of the things you were in charge of in terms of like, you know, the restaurant
so nice.
Jeez, build out and you know, Fenway and the Greenway Garden and everything. Like it was impressive. I was in my, you know, in production, and we weren't really expanding at that time. It was like, you know, we're in a groove. I just need to sustain this thing basically for the, like that was my role for the entirety that we worked together, and to see you build these like incredible projects was just mind blowing. So.
Well,
it was a no-brainer for me when you called me up. I was like, oh, work with this guy again? Yeah. Yeah. Like,
well, I can do that. But it wasn't just me. I mean, there's like a whole huge amount of people at Trillium and a lot of resources to be able to do that stuff, which is very helpful. But I mean, like, you know, for me calling Zach, it was a no-brainer really, because like, you know, when I think about like good beer and like someone who like can make really good beer and, you know, wants to make really good beer and doesn't want to do anything mediocre, this is the man right here. You know, it's like Zach Page. You know, you almost get like a little, I don't want to say single-minded, but like you start to like, I don't know. I've noticed it a couple of times when we're talking about recipes or something where we're kind of like just hashing something out. And it's like, oh yeah, Zach is like same exact page as like Zach Page as like what I would think of, you know, or what I would want out of something, but he's actually the person who can like materialize it, you know? like yesterday, double brew day, you know, no problem whatsoever. Zach's like, you know, king of the castle up on the brew deck and like runs the whole thing. Uh-huh. No problem. You know, never touched the system before. Jesus, like yeah. barely even knows it. You know, it's like, there you go. Done. Knocked it out of the park. Two beers, hit every number dead on.
Yeah. That's a pretty good proof of concept right there. Yeah, yeah
exactly.
So yeah, I said it yesterday. Like, I can't believe we were thinking about starting a brewery in 2013 with no professional experience. Yeah. Like, and then trying to pull that like that off like we did yesterday was like, no.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah. It's not like, fun. It's not fun. I can tell you. Yes. Yeah. I wouldn't recommend it. I definitely wouldn't. Yeah. I think you guys took the much smarter path to get there.
And then beyond that, it's like, you know, the intelligence of this man, not only like the brain smarts, but like the humanity and the empathy that I know he could show to the rest of the team, and the care that is there, that, you know, is very important to me from like a just like a value standpoint, mm-hmm. like that I want to have for our team when we do have a team.
With that part, that kind of getting into this conversation, that was one of the things that were one of the exciting points to talk about for me as you come into something that's already existing or try to put your imprint on it, or as things create a life force of their own, culture becomes it depends on the culture, not a difficult thing, but it's already taken its life force. You can only do so much once it's already there. It must be an exciting time at the very beginning, outside of the product standpoint and the customer experience standpoint, but from a building a company standpoint, you're at a blank slate for the culture you want to create with your employees. Yeah. What are some of the main things that you think about when you have that opportunity on a blank canvas, some of the core values or what you want the workplace that it's going to be?
That if there's one thing that's keeping me up at night, it's that, like the responsibility of having to start the culture from scratch and making sure it's a priority and making sure we give it the time and attention that it needs and really like set our priorities from the get go. We've just been, you know, interviewing the last couple of weeks for front of house positions. And that's always been at top of mind is like, what values do we come to the table when we're hiring from the get go?
I mean, for me, it's like, it's about like having that empathy and being open and honest about everything, you know? Cause I think that like, especially starting up a new team and like having like being a small team, you know, I want people to challenge us and me, especially on what we're doing, because, you know, I've always, in my whole like working life and life in general, it's, you know, you get the best ideas from places that you wouldn't expect, really, you know? And I don't know. It's always been very beneficial to me to like listen to what others are saying and doing and then acting on that. And I think if you get somebody on the team that's like just going to hang back and like, you know, say like, all right, boss, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Like to me, that's like something that it's just not going to work. You know, I don't want to be the, like the dictator up on the hill, like saying, like, you guys do this. I want to say like, hey guys, this is what I think we should do. Like, what do you guys think? You think it's a good idea for us, like as a company and like what we're doing here? I don't know. Maybe that's a little bit too like, too hopeful about like a situation to be in, but.
Well, I think it probably speaks a little bit to you guys are both of your experiences are certainly at Trillium, but then at Lone Pine at least in this current space, much bigger operations than at least this could be ever right now. Mm-hmm. Not saying that there's moving expansions, yada, yada, but there must be an element of just refreshingness to just downsize so much. I would have to think both certainly from personnel downsizing on the management front, certainly big downsizing. But also just, less to manage from production and just, all that stuff is that.
Yeah. I am excited, to work with a really small team again. Like it's been a while, where, you know, it hasn't been a team of 10 or 20 or, you know, more people that I'm working with on a daily basis. And to your point too, I'm really excited to, just in terms of the volume that we're doing and like the scale of production to get back on just focusing, you know, on each individual brew and brand and give, you know, everything the time and attention it needs. Not that a large production brewery doesn't do that, but just for me personally to get in the headspace of like, yep. I'm brewing this one beer today and that's it. And I'm brewing one more next Thursday. And I have time to meditate on that before, you know, we brew it, where, you know, it's not just go every day.
And you were, at least at Lone Pine, we're doing a lot of things from, you know, 10,000 feet up in terms of just macro, at least when we last talked, just making inventory, just management of making sure all the things work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I would just, to me, if I were in your shoes, I would be absolutely licking my chops for exactly the same reasons.
very much looking forward to it.
To take a quick, like, more devil's advocate tangent, but again, COVID aside, I can only imagine how many people have been like, well, isn't beer a bubble? Or like sentiments like that. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, really? There needs to be another brewery in Portland. What are your thoughts on that? And I'm certainly not agreeing with that sentiment at all, but it's obviously out there. And, you know, I can see why it exists from just a numbers standpoint, but it doesn't give any credit to the context and the more nuance of all that. But mm-hmm. yeah. What do you guys say to that?
That's a big one. I mean, that's been the conversation for like years at this right, point, yeah. And the numbers just keep going up, and there's not a lot of data to support it because a lot of you know, more and more breweries open every year than close.
Right.
And not saying that that's going to, you know, continue forever, but I don't think we've hit the limit. We're going to see, you know, as a trend has been, we're going to see a lot more or a lot less, you know, regional breweries and a lot smaller. Breweries definitely smaller in scale. I mean, that's part of the reason that this place attracted us so much is the scale, 10 barrel batches. Like in our minds, that seemed totally reasonable. That's that's a reasonable amount.
This is a reasonable amount of beer
per batch that, you know, we could sell locally.
Right.
And not sort of diving in, you know, too deep and kind of, you know, allow us to kind of grow naturally if need be, but still large enough that we can, you know, pay the bills.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, again, like kind of talking about this space physically, it gives us the latitude to experiment as well. You know, like a 10 barrel batch, it's an investment, but it's not like a make or break investment. You know, mm-hmm. if you're standing up like 90 barrels of beer of like a something you don't know if people are going to buy, like that's scary.
Yeah.
You know, that's scary.
But
I'm sure you know.
Well, yeah, but I mean, still though, it's just so different when it's yours.
Yeah.
You know, that there's no buffer between success and failure.
Right.
Or so with that said, I mean, especially, you know, you guys both came from, it's been a while since that was kind of your only context. But I mean, when you're a home brewer making 5 gallons at a time, 300 gallons seems ridiculous, like absolutely absurd to just an absurd quantity, unreasonable in that context. I guess it is all relative, but I would agree with the 10 has always kind of, as we've gotten, 10 just really is a sweet spot for so many reasons. Cause it just seems like 5's just a little
too small.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it still, I think, very much fits the mold where you can sell 10 barrels of just about anything once. Not making any implications there at all.
Jeez.
But yeah, I don't know. I'm really just trying to say I'm excited for you guys. get into beyond the brew house, how for cellar capacity, what are you guys working with?
Yeah, so it's sort of an odd cellar setup where there are only two conical fermenters, a 10 and a 20 barrel, as well as a 10 and a 20 barrel bright. However, there are 5 10 barrel serving tanks.
Obviously. Yeah.
So very much like a brew pub
more
style.
Serving tanks than cellar tanks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Normal cellar tanks, I guess.
They're essentially bright tanks. So it's very much like a brew pub style set up in terms of the cellar. So we're going to be getting a little creative with how we're utilizing tanks.
Yeah. I mean, we're definitely going to be fermenting. Definitely going to be fermenting in those dish bottoms.
Uh-huh.
Probably going to be paying quite a bit for yeast.
Yeah. So we'll try to get some conicals as soon as we can, but
what is the plan in the interim? I've never obviously been confronted with having a glut of bright tanks that I had to use. So yeah, what is your kind of thinking of that right now?
I'm used to it because the original Trillium spot, the only 20 barrel tanks we could fit in there were flat bottom bright tanks.
Right.
So we did.
I remember
plenty,
that
right?
in the first conversation.
I forgot that there was not a cone on the bottom.
Had to chip away the ceiling
right on the roof, but right on the ceiling.
Literally chip away the ceiling to fit
the tank in.
Wow.
And every tank was treated as a uni tank. No, you know, there was no bright tank. So yeah, we fermented.
Did you do yeast collection out of them?
We did. I mean, obviously it's you won't get the same volume.
Sure.
But in terms of, you know, viability and like the quality of the pitch and the fermentations thereafter, like it was fine. Mm-hmm. So, that was a different yeast strain that we're going to be using here, primarily. So we'll see. It's going to take some, creative scheduling with the mm-hmm. two conicals to make sure that we keep our yeast going. But so that's the cellar setup that we have.
Not
right
to
now.
Get too far into this, because I just want to talk about the beers themselves, but I've gotten interested and then not gotten interested and kind of gone back and forth about just geometry of fermentation. Mm-hmm. De La Sens, obviously, but in my head, kind of the shining example of huge proponents of you know, saying Teres Bulba would be basically impossible without these specially wider than tall tanks. Mm-hmm. And those serving tanks in there aren't quite that, but there's just not going to be as much natural pressure on the yeast from just height. Is that playing a role at this stage?
I don't know if this scale it's going to make a difference. I've definitely seen that at a larger scale, like jumping from 10 to 30 barrels with Trillium. We had to completely change our like pitch rates and the temperature we fermented at. Like, had to make a number of process and recipe changes to adapt for that. And same thing at Lone Pine, going from 20 to 40 to 80, we had to adapt every time we stepped up to make up for that extra pressure on the yeast and just the geometry of the tank. So actually fermenting a little bit warmer will help. And especially at the end for de-rest, just cause you have such, you know, a larger tank that's kind of suppressing, driving off, you know, diacetyl. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's what we found before, just having to increase fermentation temp. I think we actually, like, both at Trillium and Lone Pine, we ended up just to get the character that we wanted, not because we couldn't adapt the yeast to, you know, ferment well in those tanks, ended up changing yeast strains.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In both those cases, to something that is presented better at a larger scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have a lot of experience with we don't have to get into the actual strain you're using, but a lot of experience using it elsewhere, whether be that on a, you know, pilot scale or full on
here and there, but honestly, not regularly, not this from the source.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. So beers. roundabout way to I guess it kind of ties into the argument against saturation. It really makes it almost more critical what types of beers there's room for, I guess, or what type of approach to making the beers, I guess, is equally important. Mm-hmm. 'Cause everyone knows if the first part of that was the only thing that was true, then there sure as fuck would not be the amount of New England IPAs there are in the world. So how are you guys thinking about that in terms of, for especially within a state and city that is already full of really good breweries?
Yeah. I mean, it ties back to having a reasonable size brew house and cellar, is that it gives us a lot of room for creativity. You know, certainly with our experience, we are going to have, a variety of New England style hoppy beers, pale ales, IPAs, maybe eventually a double IPA, then no plans from the get go. It's something that I still, after, you know, hundreds and hundreds of batches of brewing that style, still love to do it. And I think there's still a lot of room to play within that, that style. I think just as an industry, it's got caught in a rut of kind of going for the same, you know, flavor profiles and the same hops. And I think there's a lot that can still be done even in a very kind of tired out, style.
He air quoted that, by the
way. But the, again, at the size, it's going to allow us to play with things that, like styles that we're passionate about that we just professionally, like, haven't had a chance to go after. So for instance, we're going to open, well, maybe not open, but soon after, with a couple pale lagers. I haven't, you know, in my experience, I've had the opportunity to brew a few, you know, brewed a few in home brewing, like really want to pursue it. But I haven't had the opportunity. And that's something, again, like 10 barrels, I feel comfortable making that, that volume of it. Having a house lager that we always have on tap and can hopefully, you know, easily move through that. And quickly enough that it, we can play around with, you know, that recipe and tweak it over time.
Yeah,
there's, I mean, a handful of other styles that we were going to hit hard, stouts, or all just any type of roasty dark beer we both love. So stouts, porters, things in that vein. But again, with this size, we plan on having sort of a few pillars within our portfolio.
Yeah.
Scruggsy, our IPA, Magpie, our pale ale, Lost Leaf, you know, our lager, and making, you know, iterative tweaks to those recipes and kind of that search for getting it exactly where we want, but, you know, and then also idea intrigues us, oh, I just heard about this new, you know, hot variety, or, you know, why you came out with the new lager strain that's only available seasonally. Like let's play around with that.
Absolutely.
So we're kind of planning on having, you know, a few pillars to build out the portfolio and then just making tweaks over time. So
yeah.
And also from a customer experience, you know, our idea with that is to, you know, people know if they like a certain brand and they trust us to make, you know, this IPA or this pale ale or this lager, what have you. Well, it might be different next time, but you know, you're going to get, it's going to be within the same framework of something you love, but you can expect something new next time.
Yeah.
Next time you come in.
Yeah.
We also have a one barrel pilot system with a two barrel So we plan on playing around with that a lot for draft only options.
Cool. Yeah. Like one of the things that I wanted to do, you know, a million years ago, 2013, a million years ago, I think I said this to you, it was like, I wanted to make porter cool again. That was like a goal of mine. It was like, make porter cool again. We'll see if I can succeed on that front. But yeah,
that's kind of, I guess, what I'm curious about, like where you see beyond, I do want to get into the increasing the scope of kind of what's already expanding on what does exist when you talk about hoppy beers for sure. But also for beers like that, I mean, I guess where's the balance between, things like that, almost just long-term kind of ideas that you have in the back here that you're finally able to act upon. Cause now there's no one to check with if you can do it or not. at least I don't see one.
Well, it's all the people coming in the door, basically.
Exactly. Between that and then between the people that are, you know, you know, you depend on to continue to be able to make beer.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, nailed the question. The balance between when you're planning out what you're going to roll out with something with pale lagers is, pale lagers, let's say, is that more indicative of Portland could use more pale lagers, or I really finally can scratch this itch that I've always wanted to?
In my mind, it's it will always be, can I scratch an itch? Can I scratch an itch that people would also want to enjoy?
That, yeah. And
maybe they just don't know it yet.
Maybe they don't know it yet. And maybe, you know, we could sell it alongside with something they already know that they want, like an established style. As long as we know we can move this itch that I have, you know, then I think we'll try to pursue it.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think about, like, the first time I and sorry, this is like a Trillium story, old school Trillium story. But it's like the first time I had 4-point pale ale, I swear to God, I sat there and I said, fuck this dude. This beer is so fucking good.
Yeah.
Like, I can't believe how good this beer is. It was that and Pot and Kettle. And like, I was just looking at JC like, fuck, man, this is so goddamn good. You know, and that was stuff that like oatmeal porter, you know, that's what Pot and Kettle is. It was an oatmeal porter. Yep. And it's like, how can you make an oatmeal porter like taste that freaking good?
I mean, you can do it so, you know? Fervently, because certainly Trillium's hoppy beers, absolutely. But Pot and Kettle for me too was almost kind of the true tipping point of like, I like this brewery or respect them versus like, I really love this brewery.
Yeah. And by the way, I love JC. I was just saying, fuck this dude. Cause he's so good. So good.
I think that's understood.
Yeah.
But that's what I mean though. Like, you know, we have the ability to be able to have moments like that potentially, you know, the potential is there for that moment because of the size and because of our experience and the ability to like, you know, take a little bit of a risk every once in a while, you know, on like even just a one barrel batch, you know, and just say like, all right, well, let's try this new hop extract. Cause maybe it'll make our beers like 40% hoppier. The perception of them will be like 40% hoppier and it really won't, you know, necessarily change the base beer, but like, it'll be like that much better or it'll meet like people's expectation, like, or exceed what they were expecting out of something, you know, I don't know. It's just it's stuff like that, that like is new and emerging that, you know, we can kind of lean on in experimentation and, you know, just cause we like it.
So put that on, let me slap that back to and apply it to porter.
Yeah.
So you're talking about it's hard to use Pot and Kettle as the exact example, but versus I'm sure your palate has obviously changed since then. You obviously clearly still love porter.
Right.
So like for that goal of making it, it's an interesting case study, I guess, because it's such an old, well defined style that really, you know, if you're making it within style, there's not a whole lot of wiggle room. So is it, are you pretty much in the same place with the Make Porter Cool campaign, or has that evolved over those 8 years in your head?
I think it's evolved. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, back then you could probably make Porter Cool again. I think now it's like everybody makes like huge stouts and you know, it's like an arms race almost to see like how much, you know, stuff you can fit into a stout and still be able to like pick out the individual like notes of everything that's in there. But, I mean, I've always loved like dark and roasty beers. So it's like, that's one of my passions, and that I hope we can like really, you know, keep driving, change on. I don't know.
Maybe you can fucking change Paul Upham's mind, because he's like such a roastophobe. He's such a roastophobe.
I'm just gonna make the slickest, like oiliest, like heaviest, unadjuncted imperial stout. I'm gonna say, here you go, Paul.
And he did, but it's always his. He likes our dark beers for sure, but I definitely I have as long as it's there, it's backed up. It's as long as it's just not, you know, like an acrid, almost acidic character. Obviously, because it's pretty easy to throw roast and roast alone.
But
that balance is such a magical thing. How do you? And this is probably a question for both of you, because we haven't fully defined it, but you have been a huge home brewer, but have never actually been a beer producer on the professional scale where you are. So there's overlap, but not so. So from a recipe side, for not to just continue to dwell in dark beer exclusively, but for what are kind of your preferences for recipe creation? Because there's the nuance is the beauty and how what that signature is like, well, it's 1% of different malts, you know, one way or another can make such a huge difference in a simple beer like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's been a lot of fun. It's been pretty easy to develop the few recipes that we have so far. I feel like we're on the same page, but how we've approached it and how I feel like I've always approached new recipe development is just like sitting down pen and paper, like literally writing out what you want this thing to taste like. What's the experience? What am I looking at? You know, like what color is the head? Like what's carbonation level? Like how, you know, what flavors I'm picking up on nose and palate and everything else. And then it's just, you know, working backwards from there to try to figure out reverse engineering it. Obviously, like we, you know, have a lot of experience on the homebrew level and the professional level brewing a lot of these styles. So then it's like, going back through the log, like what's worked, what hasn't. Maybe this wood, if we use maybe a slightly lighter roast on that, on that crystal, or, you know, and then, yeah, like you said, reverse engineering it.
So you literally mean you kind of write that out?
I've always done that where I'm like, one of my experience, like if I were going to write like a review of a beer or wow. like judging it, I'll like write that out. Like if I were having this beer, what is it? What is it going to taste like? Like? And then I'm like, okay, that's the experience now. Like
that's so cool.
How do I get there?
And then you said you'd revisit some of your old brew logs for getting to those answers.
Yeah. Like, oh, I remember having that experience with whether, you know, it's Pot and Kettle, or it's like the whole, you know, one of the Holy Donut beers, the Lone Pine. I'm like, oh, what do we use there? Oh, I really like that aspect. It really had like this nice, you know, like nuttiness to it, or it had this like deep, like caramel toffee thing. Like what percentage of crystal, what kind, and then kind of, you know, pulling the best of, or I would say like aspects of, you know, different recipes or just different experience with grain or hops or whatever, you know, we're brewing with, to try to get to that final result. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, then you write the actual review out, and it's like, well, did I hit it?
That's amazing.
Do I like this better, or?
It makes so much sense, but I've never heard that approach laid out that way.
And in terms of, you talk about going back and actually, Nick, a couple times when you've said it, it's you talking about experimenting, or even when you said sometimes giving something to somebody that they don't know they want yet, or almost that confidence with what's so much different than the one I've seen up front, the closest, that's Noah's experience from kind of starting on his own from at the very beginning, where you guys have had substantial careers in beer and then embark on the journey yourself. I can see kind of two major drivers that would be there. Mm-hmm. The experience that you've built, giving you the confidence to then feel like you can get more experimental or more fulfilled in your career, because you can really go out on a limb and give a deeper part of yourself, or give people something that maybe you couldn't have done in the confines before. But then on the other side, there's also being able to do things your own way, maybe doing things different than the way you had to do them in a professional. Mm-hmm. And that's tough to talk about on microphone. We're not trying to set you guys up for any traps or anything like that. But talk about specifically to the other side, the confidence that gives you to be able to embark on this on your own. Are you looking at it that way, that you can get a little more outside the box or experimental?
Yeah, I think I've been lucky enough at both the breweries that I've worked at to have a lot of autonomy and to be able to take chances and do certain things my own way. And like generally it was pretty successful. So like definitely gave me the confidence coming here. And it was like not a trial run. It was doing that same thing, you know, at another brewery.
Yeah.
So I do feel kind of empowered being able to come in here and know like, well, I made changes, you know, similar to that. And was successful with it. So yeah, just having gone through the motions and done and done that before in another, you know, another company has helped.
So I guess then which ones do you want to do that are like entirely different? Fuck them for making me do this.
Or even dive into to pale lagers when you said, you know, that was just something you really didn't have a lot of experience touching.
Yeah,
I can only imagine how it's like, but it's all, well, it's also
there's like a specific reason we're branding this line as like a pale lager, because it's very general. Like, I'm not going to say that I can brew like, you know, a Czech style Pilsner or a Helles or whatever it is, because not only do I not think I can do that because I haven't, you know, like two style because I haven't. And that takes, you know, a ton of experience, that maybe I don't have, but also, and I think this goes back to like the porter conversation you guys were having, and what does it mean? And does it, you know, how much roast or does it or does it not have?
Great question.
Is like when developing these recipes, it's like, yeah, we can start with the base style, but what does it mean to us? Like, what is porter to us? What is a pale lager to us? And again, it goes back to like, well, what if I were drinking a pale lager, what does that mean? What does it mean to me? You know, how dry is it?
But in seriousness, I guess I'm especially curious about that, because I would definitely relate to that sentiment for sure. Like, who the fuck am I to say I can make a German Pilsner? Yeah. I can't. I'm not German, for starters. Zero German experience, like all those things. I've felt like we almost had to like put a style on it for to communicate on the, you know, the customer facing side of things. But also I guess almost to provide some intrinsic boundaries, I guess, if that makes sense. So I don't even remember where that was going. But,
what does this style mean to us? Yes, and like putting our own. Yeah.
When I think about it, like, you know, I think about like New England IPAs, right? Mm-hmm. And I think about like Heady Topper, Alchemist, you know, and that beer's labeled an American IPA, you know, it's not labeled a New England IPA. And he always thought of it as like an IPA.
Yeah.
You know, and then people started pouring in a glass and they're like, oh my God, this thing looks crazy.
Yeah.
You know, and then everybody else started, or, you know, a couple other breweries started making New England IPAs, and then it became a style.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying like, we're going to be like taste makers or anything like that. But like, I think that that's still within like the realm of possibility for someone to not necessarily invent something new, but change people's perception of what is possible within like within that kind of style, you know. So like, you know, American pale lager might mean something totally different, and you know, we'll go down the trail to like find what that means for us. And you know, hopefully people like it.
Yeah. Not to get too granular, but does your brain first go to, when you say American pale lager, you know, does that mean American ingredients? Does that mean it's made in America? Does that mean it's created with the American, you know, sensibility in mind?
I think it's like the American brewing sensibility, uh-huh. where it's like, we're not sticking to certain, you know, guidelines. Yeah. We can go and anywhere with this. There's not some, you know, we're not only going to use these prescribed hops or, you know, we're not going to use a certain mash schedule or fermentation schedule or yeast strain. Like, we're going to do what Americans do and, you know, make it our figure own. It. Yeah.
Maybe we'll dry hop it at like 5 pounds.
You got it. That's really what I mean. Yeah.
we were talking about Notch off air, but, that reminds me that this was years ago, but the first time I met Chris Loring, they had been doing kind of like a sort of a residency type of thing where they'd have another brewer come in and use their system. And they'd be helped, obviously, because it's a new system. But he was not in a bad way, but was just kind of being like, yeah, we just had JC in here from Trillium, made a lager. Hop the fuck out of it. I've always got a kick out of that. To move on to the obvious then is IPAs, you know, that's Matt was kind of saying it. And I don't think it needs to be with the, you know, undertone of, well, they weren't doing it right at the other place, but if, you know, you're not the other places that you've been, you know, so there has to be some of that same itch scratching of like, yeah, you just get into a little bit of that, like how your approach to that's going to differ, especially just in a world where that's such a hard question that question becomes harder to answer, I think, every day. Like, what makes your IPAs your IPAs?
No, that was daunting. Like when we first started talking about, IPAs that we would make, is like, how do we differentiate? And if there's one style you have to differentiate in, it's that,
right?
Cause you don't just want to blend into the other, thousands of IPAs on the shelves out there. I think there's still a lot, you know, there's a ton of room to play even within that style. I think as an industry, we're kind of like, we're in a rut with making tropical, you know, citrus forward beers. We were joking. We got, you know, samples from a hop company, and they have their newest, you know, hops, experimental hops. And there were like 6 outlined on there, and literally like they had like 3 descriptions for every hop. And it was all the same. It was some combination of
orders,
tropical, just different orders, tropical citrus, you know, pineapple, pineapple,
just fucking mango, like citrus. The descriptors are never that great anyway. Just fucking lie. Just make something up if you're the, because it as the, in, I've been in the same position so much as like, why are all these here? Like, it looks like there's one new variety. And yeah, even that looks like it's basically Citra. But anyway, it's just a little pet because I totally know what you mean. It's like,
yeah. But I mean, I think you can make a New England style IPA that is bitter. That still tastes good. You can make a New England style
IPA. It's like maybe a little drier too, you know?
That's maybe a little drier or maybe, you know, a little more on the resinous, or, you know,
we're already kind of doing that, but
yeah,
I'm completely kidding.
Yeah. And it's definitely not to downplay, or not downplay, but like, we're going to do it, you know, markedly differently than places that we've worked. Cause I love Lone Pine's Hoppy Beers. I love Trillium's.
Totally.
Oh yeah. I miss drinking Trillium beers every night.
Yeah.
But never has there been a blank slate like this, you know, for either of us to just say, this is our playground. Like, we can do, you know, all those hops that we were interested in, all those products that we wanted to trial, those avenues that we wanted to go down, we can do it.
Like the different, even like the different color, you know, like, I don't know. The beer we have here is very pale.
Yes.
Yeah. You know? That was
my, yeah. It almost looks like a wit in the glass.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Like truly like a wit, not kind of that more golden haze.
Yeah.
How about for hops? What are, you know, outside of the noise, what are some of those ones you want to, or maybe even have already gotten into, but what's that going to look like for uncharted territory for you guys?
Yeah. I mean, already we've gotten into hops that I haven't used before. I don't know about you.
Yeah.
I've always intrigued me.
Yeah. I mean, just like one example, you know, I'd been reading a lot about like Michigan Chinook, you know, and
I've heard that's really unique.
There's so many brewers that like, they like whisper it, you know, like they could be like, yeah, you got to try like Michigan Chinook. Michigan it's so good. So, I mean, like stuff like that, you know, is super interesting. But again, like, you know, is it just like Citra? I don't know, you know, but you know, it's a little bit different than, you know, traditionally, but some of the other stuff, like, what we're using in, Scruggsy, like the first iteration of Scruggsy.
And that's the flagship IPA.
IPA. Yeah. We're going with like a combination of, Enigma and Brew One. And backed up with a little bit of Citra as well. Citra, like Lupo Max pellets. But like both Brew One and Enigma and all hops that are interesting to me, again, because I mean, I love Citra and I love Mosaic and I love Galaxy, and they're incredible hops.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Would make killer beers with them. But it, you know, it's the same three in rotation all the time. And I love a hop that is just distinct and is almost like hard to describe because it's almost like a base flavor. Like I think of that about that with Nelson. It's so distinct. You can't Nelson's Nelson. Nothing else is like it. I think Enigma is similar in that same way.
I'd hope and with the name.
And is really underutilized, but has always been one of my favorites. And then Brew One, which is new to me, but when we were trialing it, you know, had like, it had a lot of tropical fruit character, it's not like I'm reaching for, is that pineapple?
It's like, no, it's pineapple.
That,
yeah.
No, that right. is clearly, right. yeah. Pineapple. So, I love hops that are just, that you sniff it and you kind of step back for a second. Like, wait, what is that? Is there something else in here that I'm not, you know, aware of? Mm-hmm. So that's the direction we're going to start. Something that's super important to both of us is supporting local agriculture. So we're going to use as many local ingredients as we can, given, you know, the style that we're making.
I saw the Blue Ox stuff on the Instagram.
So we're utilizing Maine Malt and Blue Ox for all of our malt that they can supply. Outside of, you know, some specialty, stuff. Mm-hmm. And then even for the hops for one of the hops in, Magpie, which is our flagship pale ale, is Cascade grown at the hop yard.
Oh, awesome.
Oh, hell yeah.
And pelletized.
Pelletized. Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
And kind of want to make a point of making, you know, a New England style IPA with, you know, not exclusively, but primarily local.
New England.
Local ingredients.
Yeah, New England ingredients.
New England hops.
Have you played with their Cascade enough to kind of have a real conception of the I guess terroir would be the kind of bastardized phrase for what I mean. But same with Michigan Chinook, you know, it's pretty well accepted that that is almost like a, you know, stepbrother of Chinook, like a,
right,
an evolved version of Chinook almost. Mm-hmm. And the hop yard guys certainly are very proud of that in their cascade. I just haven't used enough of it, honestly, to be able to.
I felt pretty comfortable. I'd used it twice at Lone Pine before and was like thrilled with it. And I think they're going to continue to use it as well. They're pretty happy with the results, but yeah, it's definitely not your classic cascade. I get like more of a woodsy character out of it.
Uh-huh.
For sure. And also has like this Tutti Frutti, bubble gum, but not like fermentation off flavor bubble gum, but uh-huh, like that, just like, you know, artificial fruit that you get in like zebra stripes or something,
yeah,
like that. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That artificial fruit that you can get for like 0.7 seconds and then it's gone.
One
and
then it's
gone. And then it's out of there.
But it was just you know, it's not what you're expecting, you uh-huh know, traditional cascade. And I just like that it tells, you know, a story with, you know, adding this different character, you know, same rhizomes, different environment,
yeah. Well, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
totally different, yeah, totally, I mean, different.
Could be result, different phenotyping and all that kind of stuff too, like selectively breeding and, you know,
yeah,
like, oh man, this one branch was amazing. Like, let's pull rhizomes off of that one and like plant those and see how that comes out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like that kind of like selective, you know, growing from farmers. I don't know if they actually did that. I have no idea. I'm just like talking, mm-hmm, but like that's like, it's interesting to me that, you know, agriculture can do those kinds of things with like similar base products, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
I'm sure Matt will want to talk about this, but I think you're kind of hinting at some of the context for the naming and just sort of conceptualization of this brewery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
First, but I think it comes a lot from agriculture, from your, you know, time growing up. But
question, yeah, one, what is a bellflower? Because there's a ton of geography,
right,
based around that. And even in Googling it prior to this, found a ton of cities and towns, yeah, everywhere named bellflower. Why the name, and what is the branding side of what you guys want to share with people?
Yeah. So my family has been in New England for a long time, like a really long time.
Humble brag.
Since, yeah, like the 1500s, 1400s.
I can't remember. My mom is the genealogist. Actually, like a bunch of people on my mom's side of the family are like amateur genealogists.
It seems like you're a budding one talking about, yeah, I mean, Clickman off branches. Yeah,
I like all the folklore, I guess, uh-huh, you, yeah, know, behind all of it. But anyway, so, you know, we're like old school New England, like been here forever. And we have this property in our family that was a farm. And it's, you know, it's like 200 years old. You know, my great, 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 I think it's just three greats.
That's a lot of greats.
Grandfather, you know, they had like lived in New Hampshire and like, you know, had these huge families, and like the families kind of broke up and went to different towns. But my great, great, great grandfather ended up settling in this little town in New Hampshire and like bought, I think it was 30 acres originally for like $30, something absurd, you know, like literally $30.
Dollar an acre, baby.
Yeah.
Buy land. They're, yeah, not making any more of that.
Exactly. Yep. And, you know, it had this little shack on the property that was probably the size of this tap room, like literally with a second floor.
Yeah.
And, you know, he spent like 2 years building the house that's there now, and bought the barn and like a town, like two towns over, took it all apart, put it on ox carts, brought it up the mountain, and then like rebuilt it on the property.
So would this be like mid 1800s? I'm, yeah, trying to do the math.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Mid 1800s. It took them like 2 years to actually like build the house. Like
dug, a lot of ox cart trips. Oh yeah. If nothing else.
Like dug out the foundation by hand, you know, rolls like these huge boulders into the hole to like, you know, build the house on.
Jesus.
Proof that aliens did not make stone.
But, you know, like, so it's always been like really inspiring for me that place, you know, just having that in our family and like,
yeah,
that, being able to see that like history and, you know like where your roots are from, like explicitly, yeah, where they're from, right, like, right here, you,
right,
know, in this like place.
And so few people get that.
I know. Yeah.
As well, you say, that centralized nucleus, yeah, exactly, of family.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so, you know, fast forward to more present time, you know, it's not a farm anymore. It's really just like a, like kind of like a family gathering place. or like a vacation kind of place for the summer. And one of the more recent names of the farm was the Bellflower Farm. And it was because I think it was my great grandmother. She had planted, I think it was her, again, family folklore.
Yeah.
I think she had planted these apple trees on the property. It was either her or her father, my great, great grandfather, had planted these apple trees on the farm. And this one tree was everybody's like favorite tree. And they called it the Bellflower tree because when the apple, the blooms for the apples come out, they kind of like hang down and they would just look like little bells on the tree.
Cool. Gotcha.
Yeah. Eventually it fell down, but, they kept the trunk of the tree and it's hanging in the barn now as like part of the, you know, just part of the ambiance, I guess, of the barn. But,
Tree is in the barn.
Well, like it fell down and they just like cut the, you know, the trunk. So it's really just awesome. Like the trunk of the tree.
Yeah. Wow.
But there's, I think 4 of its siblings are still alive in the front yard.
Wow.
But anyway, so like this farm's been in our family for so long and it's, you know, it's very meaningful to me and like very personal to me. And it's like, it's weird to like put that out there. And I was super nervous to like even suggest the name to Zach.
Just to Zach?
Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome. Because
it's like, you know, this is so personal. Like it probably should be something about like both of us.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you guys probably know, you talk to like brewers, naming is like super hard.
Oh,
like
we just resorted to the most easy thing we could possibly do. Cause right. It was like, what the fuck else are we going to call it?
Yeah.
It's so funny what you said, what we had when Zach Ross was on with Marlowe Waterston Ales, he wanted to build in that layer of almost vulnerability and being so personal and naming it after his grandfather so that he couldn't like back out on it in any way. Like I'm going to set it up so that I have to deliver.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe a little much, but
far eager to share, doing well. I see it getting tagged on Instagram.
Go. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's where the name of the brewery came from. And then like, you know, some of the pillar brands we came up with, like pull names from that and the rest of our like personal kind of experiences. So like,
post a picture of the bottle on Instagram on Monday when we put the thing up.
Cool.
But tell the story for that one.
Oh yeah.
Hard to obviously describing a beer label over a microphone.
Super easy.
It's kind of like doing tastings on air, but describe it. I'll post it and just an incredible story.
Cool. Yeah. So the property it's in New Hampshire. It's like right now it's 60 acres, you know, over the course of whatever, it's been bigger and smaller, but it's 60 acres right now. And one of the, natural features of New Hampshire is having a lot of granite everywhere.
The granite state.
Exactly.
Born and raised. I know.
So, in this one area of the property, there's like a stream that comes through. And, you know, it creates like a natural sort of valley. And this one part of that like naturally created valley, there's these outcroppings of rocks that it's too uniform to be naturally formed. It's like a little cave, you know, and when you're a kid, it's like so cool.
Oh yeah.
Like, cause you're like, oh my gosh, I can go out into the woods and like play in this. Like,
sounds like it'd be so cool as a 31 year old man.
Definitely. Yeah. You know, it's like the secret clubhouse. It's like the clubhouse for the kids. So that's the name. It's called Secret Clubhouse. But it's this natural granite overhang that they kind of, somebody at some point built out into be like more of like a cave. And what I think it was used as a hunting blind, like way, way back in the day when there weren't trees in New Hampshire and like it was all open fields, you know, because you could sit in that hunting blind, you know, right by the stream and like watch deer and whatever come down in the valley and like, you know, drink water and then, you know, carry on. Like it would be the perfect spot to just like tag them.
So yeah.
You could bring food home.
I've never seen it in real life. I've only seen one beer bottle and heard you tell the story. And in my mind, 1,000,000% chance there were people in that blind hunting years and years and years ago.
Yeah. So it's like, it's just like super cool. And it's one of those things that like, again, you know, having this crazy house and this crazy story about this farm, and then you add on like, oh yeah, we got this Native American cave that's like nobody knows, you know, again, it's like family folklore. Who knows? It could have been the great, great, great grandfather that like, you know, put the blocks in to like make it. But
yeah. What do you mean when you say just, I'll have to look at but what do you mean by build? How do you build out a cave? What do you mean by that?
Well, so like the way the granite looks like it kind of like evolved over time is that it was a slab that either fell down and just was propped up on the edges. So it kind of made this like overhang. And then they, you could tell that somebody like tucked rocks underneath it to like keep it up. And then there's older pictures that we have of it where it's like perfectly square framed out. That's like, you know, nature.
It's where Bilbo Baggins live.
Yeah. It's like nature doesn't do that, you know?
Wow.
when he did bring the idea for all of this, for the name of the brewery and some of the branding concept, and it was so personal to him, what did you think right away?
Well, without knowing the background of the name, we had like a short list of names. Like we all just threw kind of names in a hat. And we're like, what, like let's look at these and let's see what works. And both Melissa and I were just intrigued by the name. Like we just wanted to know more, just hearing Bellflower, like, how did you come up with that?
Yeah.
And I knew your family had a farm, but I didn't know like the history of it and how that, you know, specifically that name came to be. And then you told the story and I was just like, yeah. Of course we're doing that. Like that's a great story. Like everyone needs to hear that, you know, story. I had no like reservations about the origin of the name not having to do with me or my family.
You seem like just the kind happy. Of guy that you go the other way. Well,
I went to summer camp once. It's called Camp Onawana. Well, I don't know if that works. That's also trademark infringement.
There you go.
Here we are.
that's not me. And I was just super psyched to be able to include kind of like Nick's history in the story of that farm. And, you know, the fact that we are tying in this little piece of New England into our brand.
That was the other part that was really important to me, was that like that we tied, you know, some sort of like physical geography to the brand, just because like, I don't know. I mean, the way I think about New England is not just like the individual states, but like, you know, the totality of it really, because, you know, they're all part of a whole collective. And I think, you know, in general, you know, us New Englanders like tend to like work together and support each other. And, you know, going back to like talking about agriculture, you know, it's the reason that we're alive right now, I guess, you know, we can't live without farms. And, you know, for me personally, supporting local agriculture is hyper important, just from a, like a food security standpoint. Like you don't want to have to rely on, you know, trucks coming from the Midwest, bringing grain just to make bread, you know, when literally like we have a huge bread basket in Maine, you know?
Yeah.
And if we ignore that and we don't care for it, it'll go away. It will just go away. So, you know, it's again, like now it's on us as business owners and, you know, too, that, you know, it's our responsibility to take these things that are important to us and really make them a priority.
Absolutely. So,
you know, part of that is, you know, just knowing that, you know, my family were farmers. They were chicken farmers. They weren't like grain farmers or anything. Mm-hmm. They literally had like a huge chicken coop. And you know, I even have like the old ledger with like all the eggs they would sell. But
that must be quite a lot of inventory.
Well, yeah, it's like sold 136 dozen eggs like in 1 week, you know, like crazy stuff like that, you know, but whatever.
I would not be a good chicken farmer. I can tell you that, the nine that we have. Well, you guys both have families, as we've alluded to, and I'm sure there's no shortage of you spending time here. I love
spending time here.
So you've been more than generous, but second to last thing before we wrap, just give kind of a final timeline of everything for when we in the world can expect to see your beers.
Yeah. So we got our final licensing approval this week, brewed for the first time. So as soon as that beer is done,
what were those two beers yesterday that were brewed?
We brewed Magpie and Scruggsy, so our pale ale and our IPA.
Cool.
Awesome. Cool.
Brewing some lager tomorrow.
Yep.
So we have, even though we do have a canning line sitting on the floor over there that we may need your help picking up and putting on a table. we are going to have Ironheart come in for the first run, just with the volume that we're doing and not having our feet underneath us with the line yet. Totally. So we have them scheduled for the last week in March. So we're targeting the last weekend in March.
Yep.
Awesome.
Fast approaching. Yeah.
Very fast approaching. Very, very scary.
And where for awesome. Anybody listening, especially local, that to get information or anything you want to plug in terms of location, social media outlets, where can people find out more about Bellflower?
check us out at Bellflower Beer on Instagram. It's probably the place we update the most.
Yeah.
We'll probably use like Facebook as like a longer form place to post stuff. So you can follow us there too. Bellflower Beer.
But yeah, in case we didn't say, we're at 66 Cove Street in Portland. So we're in the East Bayside neighborhood, right alongside, Urban Farm and One Pine and Rising Tide and Austin Street in that whole neighborhood. So
yeah. Literally all within, what do you say? 5 iron?
Oh, yeah. I mean, maybe on a good day, maybe a 6. You know
oh. 8. Easy. It's a long pine.
I played a lot of golf last year.
That just to say, this is a crazy hub right here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not to mention, Oxbow's literally right up the hill and a slew of restaurants. It's a really cool place to be. As I told you guys, I used to live, quarter mile down the road and miss it pretty much every day. Love where I'm at, but this is something special you guys moved into here.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, a big selling point for me was just being able to have lunch at Ramona's or ANC Grocer or Forage or all these other
awesome. But before we end, you've done it. This is going to be your first time, and this is actually my favorite when it goes this way, because as you were talking about 5 minutes ago about all of the names that went into the hat, and we were telling the story of Bellflower, we're going to pull an audible from what we planned to do, and this is my favorite. So we're going to give you guys the 3-bay.
And you both are doing bay? It?
I think we do a 6-bay for the first time.
6-bay? Okay.
Whoa. It's either going to be a 1.5-bay or a 6-bay. And I think 1.5 is going to be tough to do. So we're going to go 6-bay. You're each going to do it separately.
Okay.
This will work. I need 3 names for this brewery that we are sitting in that were in the hat.
Oh my God.
That were not Bellflower that didn't make it.
Can I cheat? I look at the Google sheet?
Yeah. Cheat away. Absolutely. Yeah, cheat away.
Then we can talk about what was or not what is, what could have been, I guess.
Okay.
And you're going to pair them up with 3 formative beers. Just 3 of the most formative beers, anything, fond memories that sparked interest in craft beer and have us sitting here today where you guys are about to risk it all, as they say, to open this brewery. So 3 names that Bellflower could have been paired with 3 formative beers.
Is that abstract enough for you guys?
any reason to pair them together could be anything. You know how this game goes. You've got the Google sheet up. Nick's kind of looks like he's chomping at the bit to do it.
This might be the one that I didn't share with Zach. It has even more names on it.
I can see it. From across.
There being 6, but we're good. I glanced at that. There's at least 20 names on there.
Well, I was going to say when I said we can make this work, you can reuse names. I will make that clear. Like between your 3 and your 3, there can be some overlaps.
So I'm actually wearing the name, one of the possible names that I threw on the table, which was After Midnight. Which is, I'm wearing a shirt from Coolidge Corner Theater in Boston, which was like my local theater that I love to go to. And they had these like midnight showings of movies, often horror films.
I've been looking at that shirt all night.
That's cool. Shirt. That's a really cool shirt.
After Midnight makes you think of a big dark beer. I'm from Indiana originally, so going up to Munster and participating in Dark Lord Day was something did in my early 20s. So, and that really that was my first like, oh my God, how many people are standing in line for this beer? Yeah. Like, and they just have metal bands playing like in the middle of the cellar. People are like,
wow.
Half the people are in a mosh pit and the other half are just like crowded around the kegerator pouring like all these variants of dark. So I'm going to pair After Midnight with Dark Lord from Three Floyds.
That's awesome. That's an amazing way to start.
Nice. All right.
We'll do a back and forth.
You want to go next?
Nick,
all right, I'll
next
think
one.
Of the
all right, I'll
next
go.
One.
I'll go. All right. So I'm not sure I ever shared this one with you, but I'll say it on here. So Tekenu Brewing Company. Does anybody know what a Tekenu is? So
sounds like a Japanese sword.
No, it's actually, those like big obelisks that they have like in the ancient Egyptians put up in like different places.
Also don't know what an obelisk is.
It's like the big pointy thing. That's like it looks like a pencil basically. And they like stuck them straight up in the air and they were huge. Like they're, There's
Jamie,
one.
Jamie, can you pull that up?
But anyway, it's like this obelisk to, I think it was like, I don't know, one of the gods. I'm probably going to mess this up.
So I'm sure. Oh, pointing.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I think it was like to Horus. I think that's what they were for. Like the god of the underworld. Is that right? Maybe. I don't know. Oh. Anyway.
Oh, so it's basically like the Washington Monument.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I got okay. A bunch of them.
Two Jamies here.
But I always thought that would, you know, you could always come up with like cool branding with something like that and like change the symbolism.
Totally.
Yeah.
But I think I'll pair that one with one of my OG favorites. Oh my God. Two Hearted. Bell's Two Hearted. Awesome. I love that beer so much. Like that was a not a desert island beer, but it was pretty close to a desert island beer for me for a while. I love that beer. Like, you know, it's classic IPA, like super bitter, but like, you know, very, very, very dry hopped, like heavy aroma, like dank, resinous, piney. I don't know. I just love that beer.
So very distinct for being a centennial.
Oh yeah.
And even for the age of it, it's just, to me, it's always been Two Hearted's its own thing, even though it's exclusively, you know, hop with one of the most traditional American hops you can get.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you're essentially saying if you were trapped on a desert island with nothing else but an obelisk, Two Hearted
Two
Hearted
is the beer.
There it is. It goes. Back to Zach.
So one that we're using this name for our the first lager that we're putting out, Lost Leaf. That's one that I threw in the hat as a possible name. Then Lost Leaf, it's the name of a house bar in not Tempe. No, in Phoenix, Arizona, that I went to when I was 20 with Melissa, who was also 20, so we were underage, but they didn't card us.
and pretty and important.
There was just like a jazz bassist playing in the corner. It's like, it's very strange. It was very much, it was like someone's house. Like, I don't even know how we found it. On vacation with my parents. But this place just always stuck in my mind. Like it was just so odd. And like, they let me in, I'm 20 years old. And I remember having, a rogue. Well, is it just nut brown or no? What's their brown ale? It's gonna kill me.
Hazelnut brown.
Hazelnut
nectar.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah. I remember having that at that bar.
Uh-huh.
Listening to this jazz basis and like what's basically a living room. And Lost Leaf since then has always been the name of my Wi-Fi network. So
awesome. Wow. So that sounds like a Wi-Fi. Yeah. That's so just a perfect name for a Wi-Fi network also somehow.
So just drive around Portland, look for Lost Leaf.
Not password protected. You're good to go.
It also, I have to just say this real quick. Are you guys big office people?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's one of the Christmas episodes. I think it's where like Michael becomes suave Michael to try to win back Holly. And the lone jazz bassist is a big part of it because he's too cheap to pay for the whole band to play Christmas. So there's just a one kind of the humongous upright bass just strumming notes. So that's what it makes me think of. And that must have been, I'll say this, I'm not surprised that has stuck in your head for this.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's very awesome. Odd experience, but man. I still remember I was drinking Rogue at, at that time. So
Wow. That's great answers.
One. Man.
Halfway through the sixth. Yeah. All right. Nick, you're up.
All right. So this is one that I think we had talked about this name back in 2013. And then I brought it back up again for this one, but we didn't end up using it. It's Black Cap Brewing, which I think actually is another brewery now, in like Baltimore or something. But the Black Cap Chickadee is, you know, native to New England. Love that bird. It's like ubiquitous. My favorite bird.
Is that the mainstay bird?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know it was,
you can always tell cause it's got a black head.
Yeah. Right.
But we didn't end up naming the brewery that, but you know, to me, like it says New England and you know, when I think of New England beers, I just have to go to Trillium cause I had that like literally sitting there and I have a picture of it.
He's back on the porters again.
Yeah.
He's back on the porters.
No, for real. Sitting there, like literally sitting there, like JC, you know, pouring out Pot and Kettle for everybody and like drinking that Pot and Kettle and just going like, fuck this dude. This is so good. This beer is so good. So I'm going to say Pot and Kettle with Black Cat Brewing.
Hell yeah. Love it. Hell yeah. That's, man, killing it. Mm-hmm. All right. Back last to, ones.
Last okay, and okay, final.
I may deviate a little bit from the rules if that's okay.
It's a six bay. I think everything's out the window at this fucking point.
It wasn't a serious name that I ever thought of if I opened up my brewery, but what I always called like my home brewing brewery, whatever, was Birdface Brewing Company. Uh-huh. And the reason being is just something I would do to Melissa if she was my wife, Melissa, if mm-hmm. she was just sitting around not paying attention on her phone, I would get like so close to her face that my nose is on her nose and then caw like a bird. I'm just like, caw! So we called it bird face.
And she went, just like she loves that.
Just, really gets her going. So I just, you know, Bird Face Brewing Company is what I call my homebrew setup. I'm gonna pair that with, so at our wedding, I brewed a beer for it. And for the it was like a German wheat beer, like a Hef. And named it Wheat Melissa, like a play on Sweet Melissa.
Hell yeah. So, yeah. I got it.
That's so good. So I'm going to pair Wheat Melissa with Birdface.
Birdface.
Awesome. I love that.
The Man. Most personal answer in the history of three bays.
I love it, dude.
Wow. Last and final.
Okay, last one. Nick. This is another one I don't think I shared with the group this time, but after the Trillium College, when we had gotten Trillium open, you know, I decided I wanted to open my own brewery. So I'd moved to Connecticut because I was going to open it in Connecticut. And the name I came up with was Good Day Brewing. So cheesy, horrible, like really, GDB.
It's
really
not great,
cheesy.
I'll be honest.
Yeah, it's like so, so cheesy. Like not a marketing genius back in 2013.
It's better than having a bad day, I'll tell you.
Yeah, it's true. Very true. And I'm going to pair that with The Opposite, which I think is an amazing beer that I love so much. And I've been drinking a lot of since I moved up here, which is Lupolo, the Italian Pilsner from Oxbow. So good. Love that beer. So good and
bad. Pair the good with the bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing.
There you go.
Oh, the bad being the name.
The bad being the name. The beer being the good.
Gotcha.
Great beer, bad. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, that might be that's history for that's us. History. For very, very, very niche, very small history, but that is history for us. And that was, I'll be honest. When that was laid out, I was like, you know, I'm sorry that this had to end this way is what I was thinking.
Oh, you guys nailed it.
I just wanted to know what names were in
you
the
guys
hat.
Killed that. I couldn't believe there were that many. I have a similar, I have a notes thing constantly going for beer names, just because I'll forget them, you know, think of them. Yeah. So just I'll throw it on if I think of something. But it ain't that long, I'll tell you that. It's definitely not that long. Very impressive.
I made a Slack channel this week, actually, to start doing that, like writing beer names down so I don't forget them.
Yeah, it's so they're so mercurial if you don't get them somewhere.
But, yeah.
Well, I'm just so excited for you guys. Like I said.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, just so excited for... just everything about this, you know, just knowing kind of the, how special the kind of this time is right now. And, and thanks for letting us, get a little slice of it.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah. Thanks for coming.
Absolutely. And I think as these things go, appreciate you guys in at this very, very special time in your lives. But in a year from now, when the world is normal and this brewery is banging, we're going to have to come on back and do this again.
Yep. Hopefully you'll not even 100%. Have to apologize. Hopefully.
Maybe we'll be the ones apologizing. I don't know. For some reason.
Thank you so much, guys.
Well, Zach and Nick, thank you so much. Matt clearly has to pee because he's getting up.
Have to pee. I'm taking pictures of you guys for the Instagram.
Rob Todd, 10 episodes.
Boom, boom. I'm in the mood.